everybody. Welcome to the Hoopercast Movie Hour. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your patronage for sure. There's a variety of ways to watch or listen to the show, mostly listen. You can go on to youtube.com/Hoopercast or all of the various podcast platforms where you are likely listening to this episode now. If you like our show, please review it, share it, just tell people about it, recommend us to other people. That word of mouth is all we really are wanting out of this relationship with you. But certainly just for you to simply keep listening. This week, this is a pre-recorded episode, and that Dustin and I are not getting together this week to discuss any films. We have plenty of content and movies that we wanted to bring to your attention and recommend to you. So I'll lead us off before I toss to Dustin. I've got a recommendation right off the bat here for the Olympic season, as a matter of fact. So this first thing I'm talking about is a documentary called Golden.
The older you get, I feel like I know my gymnastics better than ever.
I still have these high level skills in my body.
I'll do whatever I can to get there, and so will you, and we'll see who comes out on top.
It's just a scary feeling when you only have one chance to be perfect.
The film is called Golden, the Journey of USA's Elite Gymnastics. And in fact, this is actually a six-part documentary. This is on Peacock. This is where we watched it. We had Peacock briefly to try and watch the live Olympic coverage. Turns out it sucks for that, but you should check it out for this. Here's the summary on IMDb for Golden, just to make this more succinct for you. It follows top American gymnasts, Olympic gold medalists, as they compete for the four coveted Team USA roster spots in the Olympic team competition. So we're following these specific gymnasts, five really. We've got Laurie Hernandez, Morgan Hurd, Suni Lee, Connor McLean, and Michaela Skinner. So, this documentary gets a 3.5 stars from me. It is an educational look into the lives of five Olympic hopefuls for the USA women's gymnastics team. By now, you will know who made the team and who didn't, but I don't think that really detracts from the story they're telling, which is what the sport is, what they're trying to move away from, their current leadership, the logistics of competing, the sacrifices that their families make, and the narrow window of success in these athletes have. Again, you've got athletes you're going to recognize if you follow the Olympics at all. It does have a notable lack of Simone Biles, who I can only imagine didn't agree to be in this or something. There's a reason she's not featured, but and it could be because these I was going to say first time Olympic hopefuls, but Laurie Hernandez was on the team, so I don't know. But it's interesting. There's six parts. It's really well produced. They talk to parents, coaches, Olympic officials, and it's really interesting. Again, it was kind of, we watched it leading up to the Olympics, so you know, we saw it at the right time. It might be late if you're going to be watching it now, but if you love the Olympics and you just want a little bit more to chew on, there's also Athlete A on Netflix, but that's specifically about Larry Nassar and that whole part of USA Gymnastics. This is about the future and what they want to turn the sport into and what they're trying to move away from. It kind of shows how these athletes know they have a platform and want to use it responsibly to lift up their communities, their families, and just the ideal that the sport, you know, projects to begin with. And it's a really interesting documentary to watch in the wake of all the mental health discussion in sports, but particularly Olympic sports, particularly gymnastics, with Simone Biles. Of course, you know, Simone bowed out of several competitions during the Olympic Games, citing mental health. She just, cited the stress and the expectations that are heaped upon athletes. And by the way, athletes who don't get that kind of pressure put on them every year, like professionals, like Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, that's a lot of pressure, but he's paid millions of dollars and he's used to it because that's his life every year. He's more acclimated to it. These are much younger people most of the time, especially gymnasts, could be in their teens or late teens or early 20s. And every 4 years, they go to the Olympics and everyone knows who they are and they care. But before that, it's just training, grinding, and zero notoriety. And then all of a sudden you're the most important person in the entire country and everyone's expecting you to win a gold medal, including NBC. So it's interesting now to sort of take what's happening in the mental health discussion with Simone Biles and come back to this documentary and go, yeah, I mean, they're kind of talking about that. And the idea that being an athlete in general can be a very narrow window for you as a young, healthy person. And there's some great stories in here. Morgan Hurd talks about her activism. Connor McClain talks about distancing herself from her longtime coach because of her coach's inability to check her political views at the door. Suni Lee talks about her father's injury and what that means to her as a competitor, and what it means for her to go to the Olympics and represent the Hmong community among her in her community, and what that representation means to her friends and family. Lori Hernandez talks about kind of feeling like almost was done with the sport and kind of is trying to get back into the flow of it a little bit. Michaela Skinner story is very remarkable. You know, her talking about always being on the fringes of making the team, but never quite making it. She was an alternate in the last Olympics. You know, again, there's stuff you might know about these people in terms of how these stories end in this documentary, if you are watching the Olympics, but it's still worth checking out. And I just think it's really well produced and I really enjoyed it. So that's 3.5 stars for Golden, the journey of USA's elite gymnastics. I'm going to throw it over to Dustin now. He's got himself a couple of documentaries to talk to you about. So take it away, Dustin.
Hey everybody, Dustin here. We are going to talk today about two rock and roll documentaries that are streaming right now, one on Hulu and one on HBO Max. So the first one, the most recent one, is McCartney 321.
I brought in the chords, and then George Martin said, it'd be nice if we could have a little intro. And Harrison just went, do, 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 do. Yeah, it was good, you know.
What you got now?
I got this one.
This is-
This is why we don't go into tapes.
It's beautiful.
McCartney 321 came out this year, just a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact, and it's available on Hulu. It is, as you might guess, a documentary about Paul McCartney. And it's a sort of conversation between Paul McCartney and Rick Rubin. For those of you who do not know, Rick Rubin is a big time producer. He is, I believe, the co-founder of Def Jam Records. He's big time. So Rick Rubin and Paul McCartney are going to talk in sort of a retrospective about Paul McCartney's career and kind of break down the stories behind some songs and just sort of Paul's life and what's going on there. The series is directed by Zachary Heinzerling. This is his first thing that I've ever seen. And as far as direction goes, he has only been the director of a few little things here and there, a couple of shorts and then a couple of TV episodes. So McCartney 321 is his first big project, and he directed all 6 episodes of this series. So it is presented in an episodic format, not a singular documentary, but it does feel more like a singular documentary. I mean, each episode is Paul and Rick Rubin kind of talking about a few different songs, and it's not really even in chronological order. They're going to jump around, and there's not necessarily like each episode is about a specific thing, like, oh, let's talk about your love songs, or now let's talk about your like comedy songs. Like it's just kind of each episode is just the same as the one before it. So it has this feeling of like, even though it's released episodically, like you could probably watch all of this as one feature and it would probably be just as good. So these episodes are not super long. They're about a half hour each. So it'll take you about 3 hours to watch. But each episode is, like I said, just sort of that conversational style. And so what's great about it is you get to kind of feel like you know Paul McCartney a little bit and listen to the way that he might tell stories. And some of these stories you've heard before if you're a Beatles fan like I am. So they're not super revolutionary or revelatory, at least not all of them, but there are a few things that he drops in here, some pieces of information that I didn't know. And so that's super cool. And in a weird way, Paul just kind of comes across as being like your super fun, like hippie grandpa in a way. And it's just a lot of fun to kind of watch him tell these stories. And what's great about it is like, we know these stories because you like Google, like what were the Beatles doing? And it like, you know, comes up with a bunch of information by, you know, rock and roll journalists or, you know, people who've studied the Beatles. But it is different when you just let a Beatle talk, because then you get to hear their experience firsthand, like, oh yeah. And then we went to India and it's like, oh yeah, well, like I've heard about that, but like, it's something different to hear him talk about it because he went through it. And so the whole documentary has that conversational style. It's super fun to listen to, but I think the best part and the part that is why I would recommend it to people, both Beatles fans and non-Beatles fans, though I do think that, being at least familiar with Paul's work is probably a prerequisite. And the reason is because they actually go into some of these songs and in a way they remix them. And so they're able to take out, say, the vocals, and let's just listen to the drums and the bass. Oh, wow, that's great. And then like, okay, now let's add the piano in. Now let's add the guitars in. And so as they sort of like strip it down to whatever element it is they want to talk about, you know, and a lot of times with Paul, that's the bass or the vocals or the piano. And so like, let's talk about that. Then we add all the other layers, and then we're going to talk about like, well, wow, like John's contribution here was crazy, or Ringo's contribution really gives the song life, or whatever it is. And it's such a cool thing, because as somebody who's heard all of these tracks, I can't even tell you how many times, and I feel like I know them by heart. What's weird is like, if you take the drums out and you just let me hear maybe like the bass, right? You take the drums, you take the vocals, take the guitars, and I'm just listening to the bass. It's like, wow, I've never heard it that way before. I've never paid attention to what the bass is doing there. Or, you know, likewise, like, let's just leave in the weird synthesizer. And it's like, oh yeah, like I've always known like there's a synth in this song, but I didn't really know what it was doing. And my brain couldn't quite register it because it's buried underneath all of these other layers of tracks. And it's just super cool to kind of have them remix it on the fly. And like, Paul will get an idea, right? Like, oh, listen to this. Like, I did this, and he'll like bring everything out except the vocals. And then he's like, listen to me here. Like, I mess up here. And it's like something that like, as a guy as old as he is, to sit back and remember like, oh yeah, I messed up on this song in 1964. It's so weird. But the only reason he can do that is because he's an artist. And like all of us who are artists, we kind of are hard on ourselves, and we remember our failures maybe a little more spectacularly than our successes. And Paul's had a lot of successes, but at least in his mind, I think he still looks at some of these songs and says like, oh yeah, I could have done that better, or that's a failure. And I think that makes him really relatable. But maybe my biggest takeaway here is just how improvisational the Beatles tracks were, right? Like somebody might come in, John or Paul, and say like, I wrote this song and I recorded a demo on my little recorder here, and like play that, or they'll play it live for everybody, including George Martin, their producer. And then they play it, and it's it's like almost there. Like some of the lyrics might be missing, but it's pretty much there. But then like Paul says, oh, wait, you know, what'd be great, John, is if we did this. And he like brings in a piano and then he like livens it up. And then Ringo's like, oh, and then if we do this, and it all like adds. And then George Martin, who, you know, at least for my money is the fifth Beatle, if there is a fifth Beatle, George Martin is up there going like, oh, you guys, you need like some orchestra in the back, or, you know, it'd be great. What if we slowed it down? Right. And so it's like this collaborative process. And so that's why if you get your hands on some of these like remasters and stuff that have come out, you'll start to see, or like the anthology albums, you'll start to see like, you know, a certain song and it'll be like take 14 and it feels really different than the take that you're used to. Well, it's because like the song develops over time. It's not like they sit down, you know, the Beatles don't, they can't read or write music, like actual music. So they didn't sit down and like write down the notes and like, here's what we want, and like compose something that way. They said like, here's the lyrics, here's the general like feeling of it, here's the chord progression. And then like everyone adds their part, which is why it's always so great to hear the Beatles compliment each other. And Paul does a lot of that. Like John was great at this, or Ringo's great at that. But also when you're able to recognize the contributions of everybody individually as a fan is great, because I like, you hear all the time, like Ringo's the luckiest man in show business because, you know, here's this like no talent drummer who gets stuck with the three most talented guys in the world. And I'm like, hey, yeah, I don't see it that way. I think if you take Ringo out of the Beatles, you don't have the Beatles. And I think Paul sees it that way and says about as much in this documentary. And so what, excuse me, what's great about it is you do get the impression that the Beatles were collaborating in the studio to create each track on the fly. And as they did take after take after take, ideas formed and things evolved until it got to like the masterpiece that it is now. Right. And what's crazy about it is some of it is like, you know, recording tricks, like, well, let's play this backwards, or let's loop that, or let's do this weird thing with this synthesizer or whatever. And it's things that they can't be repeated, and they also can't be like composed musically. It's just kind of like an improvisation that happens in the studio. And that's why, like, you'll see take 22 and take 23 are very different, even though like musically they're the same, but like the flourishes that make the Beatles songs the Beatles songs are different. And that, and to me, that's just so cool. And so you do hear some alternate takes in this documentary, and you just get to feel like, you know, the band a little bit, and you know, Paul a little bit better, and just kind of really get to appreciate each person's contribution and how well that band worked as a cohesive unit, even when they were bickering, even if they weren't seeing eye to eye towards the end. Like every Beatle added something to every song that without that person, it would be a completely different experience. And so McCartney 321 is super informative. It's fun to watch. It's entertaining. Of course, it has great music. And so it's almost just great just to like have on in the background, because you'll like hear, you know, every so often another song starts, and you kind of get to hear it fresh and new. So it's a lot of fun. And like I said, it's just fun to listen to your hippie grandpa talk about his crazy times in the 60s and what great music they made. So McCartney 321, would I recommend it to fans of the Beatles? Absolutely. Would I recommend it to people who have casual knowledge of the Beatles? Absolutely. Would I recommend it to people who have no knowledge of the Beatles? Yeah, sure. But again, go listen to some Beatles tracks. It really will help your experience here to hear like the final product and then hear it remixed and stripped down is a great thing. So McCartney 321, I would highly recommend it. I gave this 4.5 stars. Like for me, this was about as close to perfect as you can get. If I have any critique of it. It's that it just kind of ends rather than what you'd expect, like a film like this to kind of crescendo into something, like a big question gets answered, or there's like this big musical moment where maybe Paul is going to perform something now. But that never really happens. It just kind of ends like any other episode would end. And so it leaves you really wanting more, but not in a good way, but in sort of an anticlimactic way. So I'm not going to call it 5 stars because it isn't perfect for that reason. But I'm going to give it 4.5 stars because I'd probably watch about 1 million more hours of this if they just kept making it. So McCartney 3-2-1 available on Hulu. Highly recommend it. The second film I watched is available on HBO Max. It's called May It Last, A Portrait of the Avett Brothers.
If there was anyone that I wanted to start a band with, it was Scott. There are all these bonds that become established when you're children.
There ain't no man can't save me.
Who thought the world was gonna either come to us or not. And either way, they were missing out.
We've been accused of being fatalist as a band, but we've seen enough tragedy in our lives, and we know that tragedy comes from out of nowhere.
So May It Last is directed by Judd Apatow and Michael Bonfiglio. They are sort of creating this documentary as a fly on the wall of the Avett Brothers album creating process. So, for those of you who are maybe not familiar with the Avett Brothers, I had a casual knowledge of the Avett Brothers, but nothing too intense. I like their music, but I've never really listened to it. So I just kind of put this on because I thought, like, okay, I just finished McCartney 3-2-1, so I'm in the rock and roll music kind of like that music doc mode. And so let me put on the Avett Brothers and see what this doc is about. So this documentary is a feature documentary. It's about 1 hour and 45 minutes. And like I said, it follows the Avett Brothers creating their latest album. And man, it is a lot of fun. So this documentary, I'm just going to go ahead and give you my star rating. I know I usually kind of hang on to that to the end, but I gave this 4.5 stars. For me, this was pretty close to a perfect documentary because it's a fly on the wall documentary. So you're not like, you know, doing anything persuasive or trying to like learn something necessarily. It's more like watch these artists work and watch them work out their process, right? So watch them write songs and get to know them a little bit better. And I had a lot of fun getting to know them a little bit better. So the Avett brothers, Scott and Seth Avett, of course, our brothers. And so we get a little bit of their childhood, their upbringing. They both are born and raised in North Carolina, and they both still live in North Carolina. And they live close to each other and close to their parents. And their life looks like an average North Carolinian. It's filled with like acoustic musical instruments, like guitars and banjos and upright basses. And they play country-ish. I mean, you know, like southern-y kind of rock and roll music. So what's great about it is you do get a sense that, you know, Scott and Seth, throughout this, you get to know and kind of see yourself in them. I saw a lot of myself in them, if only because I'm from the South and, you know, I know what it's like to kind of grow up, close with a brother and then, you know, at least to some degree, not to theirs for sure, but at least to some degree kind of pursue, art and that as a career. So, for them, they were very much drawn to music and that thing drew them together as brothers. Like, they're brothers, right? But then, like, when you put together them with this passion, they both have this same passion, it kind of holds them together in a way. And it's not like an Oasis situation where the brothers are like constantly fighting and like just about to murder each other. Scott and Seth like really get along. They're, you know, loving toward one another and to their families. And, you know, they both have wives and children, and like they're normal average people. They just also happen to write music. And that's what's great. Like, I remember I talked to my dad, this has been years and years and years ago, about I think it was probably like around the time that like Walk the Line came out, and we both, my dad and I both really liked Walk the Line, but I remember my dad saying that he wished that somebody would just make a story about a musician who didn't get caught up in like drugs and like all this like suicidal drama, whatever. And now granted, it probably wouldn't make a great story. But that's essentially what this is like, but this is a documentary, so it's, you know, it's acceptable. You know, I feel a little out of my depth when it comes to critiquing documentary, but I'll say this, at least for my money, this is about as perfect as it gets. Yes. There's not like some big drama of like, will they finish the album or won't they? Will they kill each other or won't they? There's none of that. But the drama just comes in watching them mine their souls for creative content, bring it to bear, and then put it out in the world. And yes, it's not flashy, and yes, it's not super dramatic, but it is real. And this is, I think, far more relatable than those documentaries of or stories of musicians who just, they completely go off the rails and then have to find redemption or whatever the case may be. This is just the story of some guys that get together, write songs, and have fun with it. And yes, there's hard times in it because it's a business, but it's also just about having fun and being brothers and being a band and what that means as like having a community of people around you to do life with. They talk a little bit about their bassist, Bob Crawford, who had a daughter go through some health challenges and what that did to them as a band, right? Because beyond just being a band, it feels like they are a community of people who come together, write music, and have fun, but they're also there for each other in the hard times. It's not just session musicians coming in and like, oh, hey, I'm Seth and I'm Scott and come, you know, play bass for us. It's like, these are our people. This is our community. This is our family. And it's a lot of fun to watch. Yeah, like I said, it's directed by Judd Apatow. I don't know why he chose this film, because it's not like an inherently comedic thing. Or maybe he's just a big fan of the Avett Brothers. I don't get much really of his sensibility at all in this. It just feels like any other music doc, but I appreciate the fact that he saw a story that he wanted to tell here and told it well. So if you're looking for a film that is kind of a feel-good movie and a movie that will make you think about what it means to, like I said, mine your soul and bring art out of it, then I think this is the story for you. May It Last is, like I said, available on HBO Max. I give it 4.5 stars. I do recommend it. If you don't know much about the Avett Brothers, well, I think that's okay, because I didn't know much about the Avett Brothers. I probably could have named 2 of their songs. And now I can name a lot more. And one of them from this album, the album, by the way, became the album True Sadness. One of the songs from that album is maybe one of their best songs, maybe their best song, period. So definitely check out that album. And if you have 1 hour and 45 minutes, this is a great, fun way to spend it. Side note, I didn't know this, but Rick Rubin is their producer, and so he's in this film as well as McCartney 321, which I just reviewed. So anyway, if you are looking for a couple of rock and roll documentaries, a couple of music docs to chill out to, I think these are some great options. So I'm gonna pass it back to Hooper and take off for this week. And then I will see you guys next week with who knows what, something cool though. And we'll talk then. Bye everybody.
All right. With that, we're going to throw it to the break. When we come back, I've got a couple of TV shows to recommend to you. One of them has a spinoff, and I want to talk to you about that as well. Be right back on the Hoopercast Movie Hour. All right, we're back. Thanks for sticking with us past the break. All right, first TV show I want to recommend is one you may not have heard of as much as the second one I'm going to talk about. The first one I'm talking about is Atypical.
What if I can't live somewhere else? What if I fail?
I say stuff to myself like that all the time. Like, I'm going to do something dumb and lose everything.
I was wondering if you're going to tell Dad about you and Izzy.
I think the answer is butt out.
You have these parents that support you so much, it drives you nuts.
My mom thinks me dating girls is just a phase.
You have a support system. I am a support system.
I'll be your support system.
Atypical is a Netflix series. It just wrapped up its fourth and final season. And I would say it is a satisfying conclusion. This is a show, it's a comedy, but it's a heartfelt comedy. It follows Sam, who is, a teenager. I believe he's 18 when the show starts, maybe 17. But he's on the autism spectrum and he's decided that he is ready to have a girlfriend. And so in order to start dating and hopefully find his soulmate or just, you know, teenage love, he has to commit himself to further independence as somebody on the spectrum, and which kind of has ripple effects across his family. You've got his mom, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's kind of on her own path of growth and change and everything. And his father, played by Michael Rapaport, is trying to kind of seek a closer understanding of his son and repair some damage within the family that he's caused. We've got his sister, who has her own path of growth that I won't be specific about. And then of course all of his friends and, people in his inner circle. So, everyone is kind of trying to adjust to change and explore what it means to be normal, what it means to not be typical. So the series is created by and written by Robbie Rashid and Academy Award winning producer Seth Gordon. So I'll say this. So the series was suggested to me by my wife. This is not normally the thing I would check out on my own volition because, let's face it, most of Netflix's original stuff is just not my thing, I'll say. And, you know, they sometimes make a lot of middle of the road content that checks the right boxes for certain people for a very niche group, but doesn't have widespread appeal. I might put Atypical on the edge of that. I'll say that it's, for the average person, a perfectly, you know, you should check out the first season and see if it even clicks for you. I wouldn't call the series that funny, but it's definitely heartfelt. And actually, its strength is in its pathos, even if it is a little saccharine sometimes. The show does try and take opportunities to take narrative chances and to, you know, try to take you down a storyline that doesn't wrap up the way you might think it would, or have characters make choices that are a little different than what you're seeing. So I will say it's not conventional that way, and it's really great for representation because you've got someone who's on the autism spectrum as a main character, but you've got LGBTQ representation in here. You really explore things that happen to aging parents and in a marriage with a lot of hurt in it. over time and what that does to the relationships. And so so more than the comedy helps keeps everything light, but I will say that the themes that they try to explore are pretty mature and really honest. Even if sometimes jokes or line delivery are really kind of teenagery and just not the sort of thing that amuses me, I'm always here for the seriousness of the storylines and the actual character conflict. The show is pretty consistent that way, and I'd say it has a satisfying conclusion. You know, characters grow and change, they make difficult choices, they shed bad habits, they open themselves to new opportunities, and they spread their wings, and that's satisfying to watch narratively as well. So that's all I'll say. Atypical, 4 seasons on Netflix. They're short. You could binge it in a couple of weeks, and if you like it, then you'll really enjoy the ending. And it's a pretty tight show. What is my star rating? I'd go 3.5 for this as well. I think it's better executed than other shows, and it doesn't overstay its welcome, you know? So I can't be mad at it. It's a well done show. All right. The other show I'm going to recommend, the final show of the night I'm going to recommend to you, is Bosch.
On my desk at work, I have pictures of 3 young women. They've never been identified. Their bodies have never been claimed. And I don't know their real names. Their murders have never been solved.
Why do you keep the pictures?
To remind me. Everybody counts or nobody counts.
Detective Bosch, LAPD.
Two guys roll up, toss a firebomb.
Mama!
Nobody saw who these guys were. 5 murders.
Bosch is a Netflix, is a Amazon Studios series. Starring Titus Welliver as the Los Angeles police detective Harry Bosch. And this is a character and a storyline created by novelist Michael Connelly. These are all books. So you can all, there's a whole series of Harry Bosch novels you can read. And this show ran for 7 seasons. It just finished its 7th season on Amazon. So starring Titus Welliver, Jamie Hector, Amy Aquino, Lance Reddick, Sarah Clark, Madison Lentz, Jerry Ryan, Brent Sexton, Mimi Rogers, and Paul Calderon. 68 episodes. They're around 45 to 50 minutes long. Well, this says 89. Sir, this says anywhere from 39 to 80 minutes. I don't remember a 39 minute episode, but whatever. But yeah, this originally came out in February 2014. It just wrapped up this past June 2021. So yes, Bosch. Here's my star rating. Okay, Bosch is 4 stars. It's right up there with Justified for me. It's a show that is consistently fun to watch, great storylines and season long arcs. But here we also have a commitment to deep characterization, and thank God, a spinoff to continue some stories. I'll tell you about that in a minute here. But first, like I said, I love the show Justified. It's one of those shows where not every episode is a masterpiece of cinematic storytelling, but it's always really well executed, and it always really feels very grounded and real and detailed, and just the verisimilitude is off the charts with the show. Like Justified, even if it has a certain flavor and charm to it, Bosch has that to a T. The cast is all really great. The writing is always really great. And like I said, the season-long arcs are just really well constructed, and the slow burn of Harry Bosch's anger towards the system that he represents is really great to watch and watch unfold. So I got an article on IGN here, just, you know, about the final season, saluting it, in the idea that that one of the main staples of his character, the idea that everybody counts or nobody counts, a very idealistic, even with experience and grit and grizzle for Harry Bosch, the fact that everybody counts or nobody counts. And he has this complex that way. So that's what makes him such an endearing character to watch. Even if sometimes he does things you may not agree with, his ideals are admirable. So this a couple things here. From the article, Amazon Prime's longest running series is well regarded for its crime noir aesthetic, as well as its attention to detail regarding police work. It's also adored by a passionate fan base for its thoughtful characterization. Bosch may be a crime drama on the surface, but at its core, it's a show about family and friendship and the difficulty in maintaining such bonds while keeping up with the demands of police work. It's also a series that goes to extraordinary lengths to show the side of Los Angeles rarely seen in TV or film. Also, the food, so much great food. LA is such a character in this show. And so if you're a noir fan, it really, really, really plays to that as well. It's so good. It's just a really great show. I would easily watch it again. I'd easily put it up there with my favorite shows. My wife and I just started watching this during the pandemic on a whim. I was just like, hey, I've heard, you know, we were in a show hole, and I was like, hey, I've heard Bosch is pretty good. And I was just like, we were watching it. We were like, this is pretty solid. And then like somewhere in the second or third season, we were like, this is great. And when we finished the sixth season, it's like, all right, when's the seventh season coming out? All right, it's going to come out in June. Oh, it's the last one. Oh man. So when it came out, we watched it and we weren't disappointed. And I'm also further not disappointed by this news on Thrillist. This was written back in June, so there's more information, but everything we know about the Bosch spinoff. So it's getting a spinoff, and it's not like, oh, some side character is getting a spinoff. Harry Bosch is the main character on this spinoff. So I'm going to spoil that for you. Titus Welliver, Harry Bosch survives the series. That shouldn't come as a huge shock to people. I won't tell you any other characters, but the main character survives the story here. It's not like, you know, Sopranos or Breaking Bad, where it's in question, you know, or it's integral to not spoil the fate of the main character. You know, Bosch is never on a collision course to death during the show. There's situations where he's in life-threatening situations, but the show is not centered around his inevitable failure like it would be with Walter White or Tony Soprano. So I'm going to tell you that Harry Bosch is alive at the end of this series, and he's part of this, his own spinoff, which you don't hear about very often. Normally it's some other character and you don't care as much, and they're just trying to make money, or it's a different character and it's a prequel, like in Better Call Saul, and you don't care at first. And then you watch and you go, well, this is also very good and maybe better than Breaking Bad. So we'll see. It's possible for it to be done correctly, but it definitely helps to have the main character there. And it also helps to have the most of the creative team behind it as well. So let's see. Now the seventh season is out, we've seen how executive producer Eric Overmyer and author Michael Connelly, the creator of the Bosch book series, have wrapped up all the storylines. We have a clearer picture of what this new Bosch drama will look like when it drops on IMDb TV instead of Amazon Prime at some point in the near future. So it's going to come out in 2022, it says, because it's filming right now, already filming. I'm not going to tell you specific things because I don't want to tell you what Bosch is doing at the end of the series, but he is still doing work with his particular skill set, I will say, by the end of the show. And so he's going to be doing more Bosch things, just maybe not the exact same way as we see him doing it in this show. And there's other characters from the series that are going to join him over there. And like I said, much of the same creative talent is going to be over there. Let's see who's going to be here. Will be produced by Welliver, by Titus Welliver, Eric Overmyer, Henrik Basten, Peter Jan Brug, and writer Michael Connelly, all of whom produced Bosch. So it's really cool. I don't know about IMDb TV. It's ad supported, but it's also owned by Amazon. So I have high hopes for the show. And my wife and I are really, really glad that there's going to be more stories. And they're all going to be drawing from Michael Connelly's existing Bosch books. It's not like it's going to be like, oh, let's go in a new direction, let's just write new shit. Michael Connelly is like, yeah, I've got more Bosch stories we could be drawing from. And so that's all I need to know. Source material, same creative team, same actors, one different distribution platform. So I will be checking this out on IMDb TV for sure next year. I can't wait. Check out Bosch. It's great. All right. That's it. that's it for this week. That's it for this episode. The next time you hear us, we will be reviewing The Suicide Squad, written and directed by James Gunn, on HBO Max and in theaters. So if you're going to, if you're planning on seeing that or you're on the fence, we're going to be talking about it. We'll do non-spoiler review and then we'll do spoiler review. And we may even have a guest on to talk about the film with us. Check us out next time on the Hoopercast Movie Hour. Have a great day. Stay safe. Be smart. Think about your neighbor. Care about others. And see some good stories. We'll see you next time.